I'm Agnes Ann Shum. With each of these days, I'm having a hard enough time remembering where we are when without remembering what exactly the title of this topic is. So that by the day, it's like I just get lost. Anyhow, we have been talking in this session about grief and loss issues. And just to review a bit, let's go back to what kinds of losses there are. The first day we talked about different kinds, and maybe we can generate a little more of that again. We have what we call obvious losses. What would some of those be?
Death.
Divorce.
Loss of job.
Moving.
Are there some not so obvious losses?
Loss of affection?
Mm-hmm.
Aging. It's a gradual process, and all of a sudden you realize it happened. Not so obvious, huh? What else?
Phases of health,
yeah. And sometimes that's connected with aging and sometimes not. And sometimes it can also be a real obvious. A stroke, a broken leg can certainly very quickly say, whoa, there's a loss of mobility for a while. So that, yeah, and sometimes it's temporary and sometimes it's permanent.
I start losing your memory?
That's generally associated with aging, but not necessarily.
Not necessarily. 30, 40.
That's right, yeah.
How about loss of faith because of external circumstances?
Loss of faith, How about loss of idealism? Remember the first time you found out your mother wasn't perfect? Or that someone that you had put on a pedestal fell off? Or the fact that you fell off the pedestal? There's that part too, it's like, ooh, I am not the perfect one. I am not able to do what everybody else thinks I can do, and I have to face the no, this won't work. So there are all kinds of losses. When we do have a loss, we really do go through this same grief process. And it is a process. We have also what we call limbo losses. Someone mentioned divorce. For some people it's a clear loss, and for others it's a gain. So there's a plus minus to that. What's another limbo loss?
Well, losing a job could be, because gaining another one might be something that's better
right.
than what you left.
That happened to me. I had to, it took quite a bit. Since I'm a gut person, I don't get subtle hints. But I was rear-ended twice in 20 months. And had to face the fact that I could no longer sit at the desk for 8 hours and do the desk work and telephoning and things that I had been doing. And so it was like, whoa, a real abrupt, something's got to shift gears. And that's when I found out about the Enneagram. And so it's like, oh, all right, that turned out to be a nice plus for me. But at the time it feels like a real loss. And then over time it could change. So that's one of them. A marriage could be the same thing.
For those who lost their homes along the Mississippi?
Yeah. Who knows what's possible to gain from that, huh? Anyone choosing marriage is losing the state of being single. Every birth, as I said last night, every birth is a loss for the child and for the mother. The mother has, it's like, whew, I've got to lose my independence and take care of this little one. For the child, for each of us, the minute we're born, we have suffered our first loss. loss of that security and the comfort and the protected, and so we come out screaming, don't we? No, 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 I don't want to do this. That's that first shock of welcome to the world. So we go through all of those different stages. And sometimes the stages can get stuck in them. We get real stuck in those stages. The shock and numbness is usually pretty quick. It could be almost momentary. It's like our initial reaction is, no, you know, I don't, something's wrong here. I can't absorb it, I can't feel it, I can't do anything with it. And so that shock and the numbness that goes with that might be momentary. It's not a checklist that we can just say, well, it's over and done with. But it's a momentary, and then we can move on and into that next one of the denial and withdrawal. That's like, I don't like this. I don't want this. And it's usually an unconscious. It's usually kind of a pushing away of, no, if I don't face it, it didn't happen. If I don't face it, it didn't happen. This is, I think, sometimes one of the problems with not being able to attend like a funeral, either because of distance or some other reason. I didn't go to the funeral, and therefore I can't absorb the fact that it's happened. And so that some of that denial is still there. I have discovered for myself in my own life, early on when we began to deal with cremation, it was like, no, if I don't see the person's body, then I can't absorb the fact that they're gone. There is something there that is still unreality for me. And I've discovered that over time, or, you know, if it happened to someone far away, it takes longer for me to really absorb that. I think in a situation of an abrupt, whether it's like a car crash or a heart attack or a suicide or some of those more desperate kind of things that are so out of expectation, that this stage of the denial and withdrawal is longer. You know, when we have, we may have a relative who is terminally ill. The initial shock and numbness is there, but then that denial can't be denied any longer. You know, it's like we go through that process, and so it's almost like when the death comes, we have been through the process of grief, and that's almost the ritual that puts closure on it. And so there is that sense of relief. But around all of those, then we have feelings. And I've heard people say, you know, I feel like I ought to be crying and wailing and hysterical, but you know, all I can feel is some relief. And then I feel guilty about feeling relief. And so that whole realm of emotions, our heart takes over, doesn't it? And it just kind of propels us on to, what should I feel? How do I feel? What should I feel? How do I really feel? And so we have to come back inside and say, why am I feeling guilty? And what is guilt? What is guilt?
Self-punishment.
It's self-punishment, but where does it usually come from?
Feeling you have done something wrong.
Okay.
We're not living up to the expectations we've set for us.
That's right. Usually, we're not doing what we think other people expect us to do. That's our heart center. Our heart center says, what are they expecting of me? And so I see other people crying and carrying on, and I'm thinking, oh, there's something wrong with me. For those of you who were here in the diversity class just before, there's some of that same thing, isn't it? If I'm expected to show a lots of emotion and I don't, I feel different. If I'm expected to put other people down because of their diversity, there's something that's jarring, isn't it? It's jarring. If I intercede and say, why are you being so hard on another culture, another race, another whatever, you're interrupting that, aren't you? And so when you're not not expressing emotion as you think other people expect you to, that's a jarring situation. And the emotions are in there saying, this, you know, something feels funny, but I don't know what it is. And in that grief process, we have to be able to feel it as we feel it. Actually, in all our feelings, we need to just know that that's how we're feeling. How I'm feeling is how I'm feeling. Period. Flat out. Straight out. No judgment. No judgment. The guilt comes when I'm trying to live up to other people's, what we think is their judgment, their expectation of us.
A little word like sin there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Sin creates guilt.
That's right.
And we don't approach it that way.
That's right. And, you know, and there, it's one of the ways many of the Enneagram teachers teach it from the more from the angle of sin, guilt, compulsion. And I, you know, have said no. I don't want to do it that way. I'm tired of people shooting on me. I don't need any more shoulds from anybody else. I've got a whole bunch within me that I'm trying to deal with. And then, yeah.
There's also the separation between guilt and shame.
What is shame?
Well, shame is when you do internalize it, mm-hmm. and affecting your own sense of self-image.
That's
guilt, you know, is just it has more of a moral separating mm-hmm. what you ought to do.
Right. But those feelings have got to be dealt with. Those of us who do not operate primarily from that feeling center have to be more in touch with what's happening there. With each of us, we need to say, how am I feeling now? People who are not in touch with their gut center may not realize they're feeling cold or tired.
How do you compare gut center and conscience?
Conscience is a moral, I can't find the word I want. The gut center is that physical part of us that is concerned about survival. I'm using it in that sense. The survival of the species. Some people don't recognize when they're cold, or when they're too hot, or when they're too tired, or when they're hungry. Those are the survival parts of us, and that's our physical being. The head center is the analytical thinking, logic center, and the heart is the emotion relational center. So I'm not putting conscience in there at all. I'm not saying it's not there, but in this context, I'm not working with conscience, because conscience is the that guide within us that tells us things are morally right or wrong. And in this context, I'm not really dealing with conscience. But there is a little different sense there.
Last night you mentioned about accessing all the three areas,
mm-hmm.
and that we and I understand that we tend to, our compulsions and our gifts come out of one particular area.
Mm-hmm.
The accessing of all three areas is kind of new to me. Could you say something a little more about that?
Yeah, the three, what we look for in the Enneagram, and part of what helps us to move forward in a wholesome kind of way, psychologically wholesome, is when we begin to use the heart center to do our feeling for us, and that we're aware that that's where they come from, the relational. When we use our head center to do the thinking for us, sometimes we use one for the other. And when we use our gut center to do the survival physical part. One of the ways that we get stuck, if you want, is when the head, you say to the head-centered person, how do you feel? Especially like in a grief situation, okay? Well, I feel that anyone would be sad in this situation. Is there a feeling there? Mm-hmm. No, it's a head statement. How do I feel? I feel sad, I feel angry, I feel unhappy, I feel abandoned. Those are feelings. Those are heart, okay? When I feel that, I'm back into my head. I'm analyzing the feelings or I'm giving a definition. But do you see how one can be used for the other? What do you think about? You might say to the heart-centered person, what do you think? What do you think happened? What do you think happened that this person died so suddenly? I just feel really sad because I've lost a friend. Is the question and answer, do they go together? But that's frequently what we hear. And so when someone says to us, how do I feel? How do you feel? The effort it takes to say, I feel, and name the feeling, is not natural for all of us. It just isn't natural. If we operate, first of all, from the head center, then we're going to tend to come back with a head statement of feeling or a definition of feeling. And the people who are operating from the heart center, it's hard for them to identify or to analyze, if you want, when people say, what are you thinking? How do you think about this? The gut-centered people will come up with, I just have this gut feeling. It's not a feeling. It's not a feeling. It's that animal instinct is what's really operating. Because animals instinctively know, not in the head sense, they instinctively know that they need to eat and sleep, flee from danger, do whatever to survive. That's the gut part of us. And so when I say we need to access all three, we need to be aware that all three of them need to operate. Another real quick way that that can work, when we're trying to make a decision about something, that whole process of a discernment, that we need to be able to come up with a plan. Here's option one, huh? And let me think, let me talk this through. This is not, you know, usually how we operate, but let me talk it through so it makes sense. I'm thinking, okay, option A, heart, how does that feel? And the heart's saying, I don't know about that one. So you go back to the head center, go back to the tower and say, scratch plan E. What's in plan B? And so you come up with plan B. Well, heart, how does that feel? Well, that's a little bit better. It's still not refined. How does C look? Hey, I like that. That just feels like the right way to go. Then the gut can be put into operation and make that decision operative. You have done this many, many times. How many times have you proceeded with a decision with something and you back up and say, you know, I had a feeling that was not going to work. I didn't feel like that was really the right way to go, but I thought I'd try it. Have you ever had that experience? It's when the head and the heart aren't working together. Both of them have to be okay with it. If the head says that's really illogical, because this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and the heart says, let's try it anyhow. It feels exciting. And when it doesn't work, you know, the head could say, I told you, you know, I told you this was not happening. But when we have our head and our heart in balance, then the gut can move forward and express that by following through on a decision.
How broadly would you apply that? Pretty much to all of life?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much so. Because this part of us analyzes, rationalizes, thinks up options, thinks up what are the possibilities. This part here is relational, even to ourselves. I don't know, I have a feeling if I do that, I'm going to be sorry. That's a feeling. There's no logic to that, is there? That's the feeling that's there. It's kind of, I don't know where that comes from other than it comes from my heart, because it says, I don't know, you're going to be happy with that? How are you going to feel about that? So it's you got to trust that.
I understand this, Mark, there. You're saying that you don't make decisions on head or heart feelings.
You make, the decision is made in the head. The following through of the decision, carrying it into action, is gut.
How does the heart fit in?
The heart fits in with that feels like a good way to go. It's not a head. The head says, logically, we need to do boom, 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 boom. And the heart's kind of stirring with, well, let's try it. It feels uneasy, but yeah, maybe it's okay. And the heart can, you know, in some ways be sort of, it can feel sort of neutral too.
May the heart say no and say it's a bad decision?
No, the heart won't say it's a bad decision. That's in the head. The heart has that comfortable or uncomfortable feeling of, yeah, it's okay, let's try this. Or something is saying to me, not a good idea. And that's the heart not quite sure, not feeling at ease. And when head and heart aren't together, you're going to have a hard time making that decision move forward into action. Or it will be a wrong decision. It takes some playing with that to see, well, how does this work? Fred the other day in a class said, have you ever been lost? Anybody been lost? Or as some people say, well, I strayed off the path once or twice. It took a while to get back on. When you're lost, what do you do? What's your reaction? What do you do? What do you do when you're lost?
Stop
and
think things over and try to reconstruct what you have done so far.
Okay, you're trying to get back to the logic of what happened and where are you now, huh? Okay. Anybody else have another reaction?
Become afraid.
I get afraid. I feel afraid. Can you follow that through? I feel afraid that, or I feel afraid because. So my head goes, woo, what if, what if, what if, what if? So the fear is there, and then it's like, ooh, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. What are some other responses?
Sometimes you panic a little bit.
That's a feeling too, isn't it? Okay, why would you panic?
Well, you think, oh, what terrible things, that I'm going to be late for my appointment, I'll run out of gas, I'm in a bad neighborhood instead of where I belong, you know, this kind of.
How many just keep going? Knowing instinctively that somehow I'll find the right way, I'll find the right place. There's somebody up there that says, That's my instinct. It's like I know, you know, I'm not on the right street, but I know this is the direction I need to head. And I know that I probably need to go this way a little bit. I instinctively, personally, do that.
Is that the first thing you do, though?
It's like, well, usually it's like, oh, sheesh, you know, why didn't I look up the exact address before I left home like I thought about doing? But I didn't. I mean, I didn't use my head.
Yeah, but excuse me, in a situation like this, you don't really feel lost. You feel that you are not quite exactly where you want to be, but you have an idea. Continuing in that direction, you will get there.
Yeah.
Even if it's parallel to your original.
Yeah, so personally, I don't feel, that's right, I don't feel lost. There are very few occasions when I could say I was really hopelessly lost. Then I will stop and get out the map and or, you know, check out, where am I? Can you show me on this map where I am? Because then I know how to get where I need to be. But I know that I have built in within me, personally, a good sense of direction. I usually know north, south, east, and west. It's just part of my makeup. And when I hear other people saying, you know, well, just go west up here 6 miles, and I'm saying, uh-uh, it won't go that way, you know, or whatever it is. It's like they give all these directions, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there's no way you can follow those because they're wrong. Some people don't know left and right. Fewer people know north, south, east, and west with relation to where they are. So that we need those directional signs. Some of us do have built in a pretty good sense of direction.
Seems to me being lost, depending on where you're lost, if you're lost in a city or something like that, there's help available. If you went for a hike and decided to stray off the trail and pick some berries, and all of a sudden, where's the trail? And that's a totally, I mean, there's no one else around, there's no marks of, oh, this is such and such a street, I'll just get mm-hmm. out the map. And so that's sort of a helpless kind of feeling of lost. And, mm-hmm. and I think it's a different
there's lost situation. There's really lost.
Yeah.
even with that, my inclination is now, okay, just stop a minute. You know, where did you come from? Where were you going? What's the worst thing that can happen? When you do see the sun again, at least you'll have a sense of where the direction. That's right, yeah.
But
instinctively, our gut part of us helps us survive. If we operate from the gut, then we have those survival instincts more built in. They're built into each of us, but we trust them less or more, depending on where we come from. Our head tries to analyze, and when you're lost, frequently, people who operate from the head will start trying to figure out, now, where did I go wrong? How did I do this? What happened here? As much as, how am I going to get where I need to go? And so the logic part of it starts analyzing as well as trying to find the option to get out of here, how to move forward, okay? But the heart can go through all kinds of feelings. Mine usually goes with, well, you dummy, why didn't you do it the first time, you know? But I seldom feel fear, personally, mm-hmm. as a gut person. I seldom feel fear. I can trust my gut enough to know that it will help me survive. Other people say, what do you mean you don't feel fear? I personally don't feel much fear, and I've been in lots of situations. Other people live on fear. Actually, see, I'm in that eight space where I'm not in touch with feelings as much as other people. Maybe I do feel fear and I don't recognize it. That's a real possible. It's real possible. I would like us, just for a minute, I want to review here. How many of you at this point have a sense of where you fit on the Enneagram, if only from the centers? I operate primarily from the head center or the heart center or the gut center. Okay, so some of us do. We'll do something in just a minute to help identify that further if you wish. I would like here, we have this section called self-identity. For each of us, we act as though this is all there is to us. And let's take a look at that for just a minute. And let's start with the heart center. The two operates from the heart center. So primarily they are feeling, relational people. Now feeling, I don't mean they've got emotions all over the place out here. But they are relational people. And their self-identity is, I'm helpful. If I'm not helpful, I don't even exist. I identify myself as being helpful at all times in all situations. In a grief situation, they become unhelpful. It's just that reverse, huh? They become unhelpful. And that's the stage two that we talked about some last night. I become less helpful. I identify myself as helpful to you, not to me. I'm helpful to other people.
How do you know?
You do not ever say you're not being helpful because you're denying who they think they are. What you do say is, you know, I really appreciate your help, but what I need right now is to be alone. Could be one way. What I need from you right now is some time by myself. So you're identifying your need, which is what they can respond to. And if you can identify your need, then they can hear it. Don't ever say to them, you're not being helpful. You've just destroyed them. So that if you can identify a need you have and help them to go off and be themselves or to be by themselves, or, you know, it would really help me to understand what you're doing if you could express to me how you're feeling. Can you hear a different piece in there? It would help me if you could express to me how you're feeling. That could be very helpful for them, because they're not in touch with their own feelings. They're not in touch with their feelings and their own needs. Usually it is if you're identifying it as your need to hear them. Can you hear that? You're calling on their helpfulness. It would help me if you could tell me a little bit about what you're feeling. It would help me and identify a need you have, whether it's a need to be left alone, a need to be understanding, or whatever that is. But if you can express it with, you know, it would really help me if you... You hear that? In the Administrator 3, the identity is, I am successful. As I am in my grieving process, I must be a successful griever. What in the world does that mean? I cannot allow myself to look like a failure as they're identifying that failure. Therefore, if you expect me to grieve, then I'll grieve. If you expect me to be crying, I'll cry. I'll put on the mask that you want me to have, so I will look like a successful griever. Sounds real false, doesn't it? And it is. It is. But that's the identity here, is I can't be a failure at grieving. And I'm identifying that because these are heart-centered people, by what other people are expecting, or what I think other people are expecting.
What does it mean?
Grieving means to feel the feelings you're feeling.
But what if you're not crying then?
That crying people are not necessarily the best grievers. I'm a wonderful person at a funeral because that's an okay place to cry. I may or may not even know the person. Because I have a hard time crying. I personally. And so if I go to a funeral, that's an okay place. So I can go ahead and cry. And it's all right. Do you see the expectations from other people? What is the grief process other than the process you are going through? How you are feeling is how you're feeling. And other people will say to you, gosh, you know, you must really have been close to this person because you're just expressing outwardly so much emotion. Maybe yes, maybe no. I, last month, went through an experience where a 3 who was facing a failure couldn't face it any longer and committed suicide. And I was the first person the family called. And really was kind of the buffer between the family and the rest of the people. And so I ended up making phone calls and planning the funeral service and the whole thing. And yeah, a lot of tears came forth. And what I was feeling was relief, because I knew this woman was on the verge of suicide for a year. And I knew unconsciously I'd been waiting for that phone call. I was feeling relief. And so my tears were more of relief than sadness. Other people interpreted them like, oh, I didn't realize you were so close to this person. I don't need to do all the explaining that has to go into that. But I was feeling a whole different set of feelings than everybody else. And the family was struggling with their own feelings, how could she not go through what she was facing, but could put us through this? So the anger was rising up, huh? So all kinds of emotions are happening in there. And basically, how you're feeling is how you're feeling. Our head judges our feelings. Our heart feels them. There isn't any one way. There's no one way to grieve.
Well, I find that I have delayed reactions.
That's right. that just says they're delayed reactions. It simply means that you're... and I guess I don't know what delayed reactions are, because there's a reaction, and then later you have to deal with the reaction. You're dealing with the emotions later is what's happening. And so there's a new level of awareness that comes in. It just comes in at a different place for us and a different time. And there's no checklist. We can't say, okay, I'm finished with that. Because they come back when we least expect it. I'm finding even now with some people, as I try to tell them what happened to this woman who committed suicide, that I don't want to talk about it with them. Because I get all of this, what I call this mushy, oh, you poor dear. And that's not how I'm feeling.
You know, I had a very traumatic experience 3 years ago, I think probably as traumatic as anybody could have. And it wasn't that I didn't feel bad about the situation, but I couldn't cry and I had a problem.
That's right.
And I don't, does that say that I'm hard-hearted or?
No, because you probably are expressing it in other ways. Not everyone cries. Not everyone cries with other people. Tears are only one expression. It's that outward visible sign of something. We cry tears of happiness and we cry tears of sadness, don't we? And we can cry tears of anger. And is that true? Is that true of you?
It wasn't true.
No, not true at all. That's not true at all. That's their interpretation, and you have to be able to say, you know, that's their interpretation. How I'm feeling is how I'm feeling. And I can't not feel how I'm feeling, but I can't put on the feelings that you want me to have. And that's, again, I think, where we accept other people where they are and ourselves first. And if we can accept where we are, then we can a little easier understand others. Suddenness, sudden trauma, a suddenness of an abrupt accident, death, whatever, usually is a delayed reaction. The other part about grief is that we don't know when it starts. We don't know when it starts. I've had people say, you know, my father died 15 years ago. I don't think I've started grieving yet. And that is real possible. It might have put those feelings on hold for whatever reason. At some point we've got to come back and deal with the loss that we've suffered but have not faced. And it can show up in all kinds of different ways. But that is a possibility. We don't know when the grief process starts, but grief counselors will say it takes about 2 years for the process. For some people it does. For some people it does. But that's not true of everyone. Sometimes no tears is a sign of the shock and the numbness kind of feeling. Sometimes no tears means that maybe we haven't really started into the grief process yet. Have I really allowed myself to feel the feelings? And maybe I have, and tears are simply not my way of expressing it. Not everyone has the gift of tears.
But some of that can also come from how we were taught about tears.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Thou shalt not cry is a strong message for some people. Yeah, and so the expectations we have about ourselves does make a difference. The expectations others, we think others have, does impact us. There's no one way to grieve. Yes?
I believe the expression of grief is also a question of cultural environment.
Very much.
For example, a disaster hitting Arabian, Mediterranean countries. I don't know too much about it, but I can see, well, in Iran it's the same difficult culture. Women are expected to grieve loudly and wildly at the occasion of that child or whatever, in an area. Or I think otherwise they would be ostracized as insensitive.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's really true, that culture adds that expectation on us. And some people have a lot of external expression. In fact, aren't there some cultures where they hire the mourners?
Yeah.
So that there will be the loud mourning and crying and carrying on?
In Jesus' time, he said, send them away.
Send them away.
We don't want all this noise and commotion.
That's right. So that there are some cultures, and so there's a lot of overlay of everything. Primarily what we're trying to look at here is, what's inside me? Who's driving my boat? And if I can just be aware of the feelings that I'm feeling and be okay with that. I don't have to feel your feelings. I can't feel your feelings. Even sympathy or empathy doesn't say, you know, how often have you seen someone, and I think particularly parents who have lost a small child, people will come up to them and say, oh, I know how you must feel. Not so. That is the worst message we can give to anyone. I cannot feel your feelings. I may know what it feels to feel a loss. I do not know how you feel. I cannot know how you feel. You hear people all the time say, oh, I know just how you feel. And I want to say to them, you want to bet. You know, and it's just like, no, I can't, I don't know how you feel. I know how it feels for me to be sad. I don't know how it feels for you to be sad. And so that message that we give each other isn't really accurate. I'm sorry you feel, you know, I'm sorry about your loss. I don't know how you feel.
What would be the appropriate expression, or what would you tell? You get to the person who just lost a child, and okay, it's not appropriate to say, I know how you feel.
Right.
So what do you say? You want to say something?
You do want to say something. Yeah. And simply what you can say is, you know, I really feel sorry about your loss. You're not saying, I feel how you feel.
Does it not always be appropriate?
It may not always be appropriate.
We had a neighbor in a small town who died at a predictable time with cancer. And she prescribed everything that should be done at and after the funeral, and expression of grief were discouraged. I do not say forbidden. But she said that it would be a celebration of her life, not of her death, because this would honor her so much more. And I have never been to an Irish wake, but I understand that after a certain number of hours, it ends up as a festival.
That's right, it's a big party.
Yeah. not an excuse for a party, but they feel it is much more appropriate than sit around and make a sad face because it's expected from you, regardless of whether you feel like this or not. It would be sacrilege not to express your sadness.
Yeah, right. But what happens is, does that mean that the people who are there partying have not experienced their own feelings of sadness? It's like they move quickly through it. They have to feel their feelings, whatever those feelings are. You know, as Christians, we say that there is a better life. All right, so it should be a joyful occasion. But hey, I'm still left here while you went on. I feel abandoned. I feel left out. I feel sad. And I need to feel those feelings.
I went to a funeral of the husband of a dear friend that I was teaching with. And the brother gave the eulogy. And he was telling about all the fun things and all the wonderful things that had happened or that they'd done together, with tears streaming down his face. That how much he was going to miss this person, and how, but still he was half laughing and he was smiling that they had all this wonderful life, and they were good Christian people, and he felt that he meant what he said. But the tears were just, you know, and here we all sat mopping like crazy too, and sure, saying, yes, he was a wonderful man, and we really enjoyed having him, but boy, we really feel his loss.
Yeah, and so, you know, our response, our reaching out to other people is maybe as simple as saying, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. You know, I just wanted to see you at this time. If you need anything, call me. There's some expression that says, I'm here for you. I don't know how you feel. I was thinking about this situation with, I think it was earlier this week or late last week, there were conjoined twins who were separated, where they knew by doing that one would die. By not doing it, both would die. And so the parents knew in making that choice what was happening. Now, when they go to this funeral and people say to them, you know, gosh, that must have been a hard decision, or at least you have one left, you know, which is also a real hard kind of thing. At least you have another child. That doesn't replace the one who is no longer here. You don't know how they feel. You can imagine how they feel. But what do you say to someone like that? I was really thinking about you as you, I'm sure, struggled with that decision. You know, or it's some expression of how you feel, but don't say this is what you ought to feel. I mean, that's what we do to each other. You know, it's that kind of, what within your heart would you be able to say to someone like that? Maybe cry with them, period. You may not be able to say anything.
I think since we're talking about grief, death, and funeral, I believe it makes a big difference how this person died.
Mm-hmm.
If it's but it was an unpredictable and certainly unplanned
mm-hmm.
heart attack, like Dick Lowe's that stepped in a shower at 10, this is completely different from someone who is artificially maintained for 4 years.
Exactly.
Complicated machinery, and eventually
right.
somebody yanks the
that's right.
Life support tool, and the survivors, especially close survivors, like the wife of a husband or a son of the deceased, I think we should adjust our feelings, even if it is false, to accommodate their state of mind, regardless of our...
There's a part of me that says yes, and there's a part of me that doesn't agree with that. We don't adjust our feelings to someone else. We feel what we feel.
Okay.
The expression of those feelings we need to be aware of, and you know, one of the things that we can say is, you know, this must feel like a real mixed blessing for you. Because they have grieved up to this time. They've finished their grieving, in a sense. They've been doing their grieving. So anticipatory grief. This is just kind of the final line. You know, and so that we do adjust it. But we adjust it with, how would I feel if I were in their place? That's that relational part of us. How would I feel in their place? Many of us, you know, have parents who are living or have been living and are in poor health, and we know that the end is coming at some point. It's always a surprise, always unexpected. But there is that sense of, they have lived their life, and this is what we're told we're living for. And so it's kind of like the final finishing, but for us here present, it feels like being left. But if we can say, how would I feel in that situation? Well, this is how I would feel. And you could say, Geely, I think I would really feel some relief, because I know, you know, your mother, brother, sister, daughter, whatever, has been dying for a long time. And I'm, you know, maybe you don't need me now, but maybe there's a point where you want to call and we could, you know, if you want to talk, I'm here. If there's anything you need, I'm here. But something that says how you're feeling, but not putting your feelings on someone else. But don't deny your own either, because they're there. The other person may be feeling that, you know, a letting go, a relief, you know, this is how they wanted us to be, but I doesn't deny my own feelings. And when somebody plans their funeral and tells them how you ought to behave afterwards, think of the control they have exercised in your life. Thou shalt not feel sad. Excuse me, you cannot tell me how to feel. It's a lot of control. Their wish for you is that you not, quote, waste energy grieving them. That's their wish. That's not, you know, paying attention to what's in you. You had a question back here.
I don't think we necessarily need to say anything to a grieving person.
That's true.
The fact that we are there,
you're there,
in comfort. And I think there's an interesting thing in the story of Job. His three comforters cease to be comforters when they begin speaking.
That's true. Sometimes all we need is to be present. And that is, again, that's still a heart relational kind of thing. Yeah, there are many mourners who could go elsewhere. Please go someplace else to mourn, thank you. I've got enough of my own to deal with. Because you end up, the person grieving ends up trying to make that other person feel better. And it's like, hey, how did this happen? You know, I came here because of you, and now you're making me feel better. You had a question?
And then sometimes a family's choice is to not have any type of service or anything. And that is very difficult. I know one of my students, 2 weeks after school was out, she was killed in a real accident. And I needed to do something to finish the process.
That's right. And there are times when I can't do it now. I can't do it right away.
Yeah,
on Friday, Fred and I are going to be working together, and we're going to be talking about ritualizing and how that kind of finishes the process and moves it on for us.
Yeah. Well,
for many of us, a funeral is a ritual that, in a sense, it's sort of completion, but the feelings go on until we can feel differently about it. And for some people, it's like a year later, I can do something with it. A year later, or later, I can do all kinds of things. It kind of finishes that process and says, okay, now I can move on. I'm still living, and I can still move forward. And we've really literally laid them to rest in our own hearts.
But in the case of no service or anything,
it's harder.
Sometimes,
it's harder.
Well, the way I dealt with it, I called the mom and I sent a note and got a little gift, and that somehow or other that helped me to get through it because they apparently had no faith.
Well, and this is where I think we get stuck in that denial. Another way that I've heard people say that is okay, so maybe I can pull a group of my friends who know this circumstance or this situation, and maybe together we can ritualize.
Yeah.
So there are ways that we have to figure out for ourselves. But with all of these, when we're thinking we're being helpful or successful, we're thinking that we're doing these things, but we haven't, we're denying in a sense. We claim that these are the ways that we work. Let me just quickly look at this again. In the author space of the four, still working from the heart, says, I'm unique. I am going to uniquely grieve. Now, what that could mean could play out with whatever the situation is. You know, my grief could be so unique that I can't go to the funeral. I don't want to go to the funeral because no one else understands my feelings. Well, that's true. However, you know, how unique do you want to be? There's a point where you can come back and be a little more human. So it's we all get stuck in these self-identities. The five says, I am knowing. I don't quite understand yet how all of this happened. I don't understand this loss. And so I've got to keep asking more questions. I ran into this with the suicide. People who really literally did not need to know all the circumstances kept saying to me, well, what was wrong? What happened? What, you know, all of the questions. And I had to keep saying, you know, I don't really feel like I need to answer that. But the need to know, that's all there is about me. I can't just let go and let it be. I've got to keep asking the questions. And part of that is trying to comprehend. Part of it is that need to ask further questions for more information. Well, how is the family doing? Is a question different from, is there anything that I can do for them? Is there any way to reach out to them? What do I need to do? It's kind of a curiosity knowing, you know, there's that piece too, and there's that fine line. But if I always have to be in the mode of knowing, getting in information, it's pretty hard to give some out. And actually, I don't need more information. The information pieces don't need to be answered. I have enough information is what the five needs to be able to say. That's not all there is to me. I don't have to be asking questions all the time. The six, the facilitator, I am loyal. Now I can hear about someone who came under hardship or let's carry forth with the death and dying mode here. Here is someone that I could not stand. And all of a sudden, they are my best friend that I just lost. There's that piece of, excuse me, weren't you last month chewing them out for something or saying, you know, I don't ever want to be around them again. And now you're weeping and wailing. There's something here that those shift of loyalties, it's like loyal beyond measure. Can you hear that? Huh? It's like, where is just the heart space that says, how are you really feeling? It's like, thank God that person's gone. And there are times when we have that feeling, aren't there? The Optimist 7, I am nice in all situations. I'm nice. How can I be nice in this grieving situation? In my own grief. How can I be nice in my own grief situation? Well, I can see that there's a party afterwards, or I can reach out to you instead of the other way around. It just plays out with, no, I can let go of that. I can be enthusiastic and optimistic at all times. Right now, I don't feel real optimistic nor enthusiastic. And that's okay to be in that mode. In the gut center, the champion 8 says, I am powerful. I am too powerful. I'm too strong to show all these signs of weakness like tears. No, I'm feeling just fine, thank you. I don't need you or anybody else. Just leave me alone so that I can express my grief in private. If we can't express it outside, we're not really dealing with it. If we can't express it to at least one more person, we're not dealing with it. And that person could be a minister, a friend, a counselor, or whatever. But until I can express it with someone else, I'm still sort of in that denial process because it's still inside me. I'm strong enough to get by this all by myself, thank you. Guess what? Not so. And the negotiator 9, peaceful, calm person. I'm okay. I'll get through this too. I'm okay. It will be okay. But it's not okay. Your spouse just died. You are now alone. It's okay. I'm okay. And you'll hear that over and over and over. There's that, keep those feelings out there. I don't want to deal with them. The inspector 1 says, I'm hardworking. If I just keep focusing on this, it's going to be okay. I'll get through it. I'll make it work. Guess what? There's a point where hard work is not going to do it for you. It won't work. It will not work. That's not all you need. That's not all you need. We all get caught in our own stuff, don't we? Unfortunately. But if we can keep sorting out, my feelings are my feelings, and you nor anyone else can take them away from me. I need to feel how I feel. I don't need to feel how I think you expect me to feel. I don't need to feel how I think the rest of the world expects me to feel. I feel how I feel. Some of you were too young to remember John Kennedy's funeral. But maybe you've seen some film clips of it. How many of you remember those scenes of Jacqueline Onassis expressing no emotion? Now, I suspect that she's an author 4. You could tell from her face that there were a lot of emotions there. They weren't being expressed, were they? And so the rest of the world says, Look how strong she is. Maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know, do we?
No.
We don't know. And so what we...
How she evolved and the face she presented around afterwards. In retrospect, you can conclude.
That's right.
What she showed.
That's right. But we literally did not know, because she did not express externally her feelings. And I'm not saying there's a right or wrong there. I'm just saying that's how it was. What did that do for everybody else, though? Like, oh, how can this woman do this? Gee, I hope I can be that brave when something happens to me. And it's like, whoa, stop. You know, don't do that. All I can do is deal with feelings as I'm feeling them. I'm sure there were oceans of tears shed that weekend because I was in a place where I could see it, I could experience it. If we put those expectations on other people, can we presume that you don't grieve because you don't cry? Can we presume that you don't miss this person because you don't talk about them? Or you don't show any kind of feeling that you're missing? It won't work, will it? We got to do our own stuff. We've got to follow our own grief process.